Breakthroughs in medical science can drastically change the lives of patients. Joining me this morning with one such breakthrough is Dr. Ron Anbar, Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine and the Director of Pediatric Pulmonary Medicine and the Cystic Fibrosis Center at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Anbar. Thanks so much for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. So let's begin by helping us understand what is CF, what is cystic fibrosis?
Cystic fibrosis is a hereditary disease that affects the secretions in the body. So the secretions tend to be very thick, and these secretions accumulate in specific body organs, most especially in the lungs, and they lead to damage in the lungs and ultimately an early death because of the illness.
So the thickness of the secretions in the lungs prevent adequate aeration or oxygenation? Is that what's going
on? Well, the thickened secretions, number one, prevent the lungs from cleaning themselves. Everybody's lungs clean themselves, and so the thick secretions don't get out of the lungs. And then that leads infection to set in. Then the body tries to fight the infection, but is unsuccessful in doing so. And then the chemicals the body tries to use to fight the infection ends up damaging the lungs.
Does it happen in other parts of the body too, or is it almost exclusively the lungs that are impaired?
The other major organ system it affects is the digestive system. About 90% of patients with cystic fibrosis are born with their pancreas not working well, so they have trouble digesting food. And one of the old ways that we used to diagnose cystic fibrosis is when infants would present because they weren't growing, they weren't gaining weight.
So that would be the clue that something was going on there.
Correct.
So when you say it's hereditary, how is it inherited? I mean, is it something, how is it inherited?
Well, cystic fibrosis is an example of a recessive genetic disease, and that means that each parent has to carry one copy of the mutation that causes cystic fibrosis. We have two copies of the gene, so if you have one affected copy and one normal, you don't have cystic fibrosis. And all parents of patients with CF typically have one copy of the mutated gene and one normal, so they're fine. But if you get two copies of the mutated gene, then you end up having cystic fibrosis. Mm-hmm. So if both parents are carriers of the disease, approximately one in four of their children will have CF.
But not necessarily all of them. It depends on how the genes combine.
Right. Only three-quarters of them will not have CF.
Interesting. But have there been attempts then to do hereditary counseling or genetic counseling? And how would somebody, be aware that they might be a carrier, for example?
Well, in 1989, we discovered the cystic fibrosis gene. So once we knew which gene caused the problem, we could test for it. So now, all pregnant mothers are offered, actually you can even test before you get pregnant, but all mothers are offered testing to find out if their child has cystic fibrosis before the child is even born.
It would make sense, though, if you thought that you might, to have this test even before getting pregnant, wouldn't it?
Correct. But again, if both parents turn out to be carriers, there's only one in four chance that their child will have cystic fibrosis.
Mm-hmm. So then it would still make sense to test the fetus, is what you're saying.
Correct.
So how common is it?
About one out of 25 people in Caucasian Americans, white Americans, are carriers of the disease, and approximately one out of 2,500 babies are born with cystic fibrosis.
So it isn't that uncommon.
It's the most common lethal genetic disease in white people in America.
Wow. So tell us what about the signs and the symptoms. You said early in an infant's life you might find that there's a failure to thrive issue. But how about...
Signs and symptoms have changed over the years, primarily because since 2002 in New York State, we've done neonatal screening. So as soon as babies are born, they are tested for cystic fibrosis. And most of the infants are diagnosed before they have developed any symptoms. And with some of the new therapies we have, which we'll discuss later, we are able to avoid a lot of the old signs and symptoms. In the past, infants and children would be diagnosed with cystic fibrosis when they would present because they weren't growing or they'd have a lot of lung infections.
So they'd start out with a lot of infections, as you said, because of the mucosa.
Correct.
The sticky mucus.
The mucus, right.
Yeah, preventing the lungs from cleaning and the bacteria growing and all of that.
Exactly right.
So right now we're at a different stage. Just what you said was really profound. I mean, with the human genome, we have been able to isolate and determine what gene is actually responsible for CF.
Correct. It's called the cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulatory protein, or CFTR for short. That's the gene that's affected by the disease. The other thing that identifying the gene helped us do is it helped us start asking ourselves, how might we correct this gene? And in the 1990s, a lot of research was done for gene replacement therapy to see if we can put in a new copy of the gene and make it work. But that didn't work out so well because of a lot of side effects from the therapies they were trying to use.
Is that conceptually something, though? I know with all the stuff they've talked about with stem cell research, the idea would be to actually be able to put in new cellular material, new stem cells that could correct these kinds of problems.
That was sort of the idea. The thing is that since every cell in the body has cystic fibrosis, you'd have to correct every single cell. If you put in some extra cells that didn't have the disease, you'd still have a lot of diseased cell there. So the genetic research that was done for CF was, for example, taking a virus, putting the gene into the virus, and a good copy of the gene into the virus, and then infecting the person with that virus, hoping the virus would put the gene into the patient's cell.
Which would theoretically
convert the cell to not have CF. But the problem was the body fought off the viruses, and so it didn't work so well.
It's very, very interesting. But something that that kind of concept may play a role in some other diseases, wouldn't you think?
Correct. There's a lot of work on gene therapy. Even in cystic fibrosis, the work on gene therapy continues to this day. There are, for example, ways of introducing genes other than viruses that are being worked on.
Well, we're going to talk much more about therapy and all of this in a little bit. We have to take a very quick break, but we'll be right back with more from Dr. Anbar about cystic fibrosis right after this short break. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with Dr. Ron Anbar. And we're talking about cystic fibrosis and some very exciting new breakthroughs in treatment. So before the break, we were talking about, what it is and how it's obviously really severely affected people's lives who have cystic fibrosis. Did it affect lifespan?
Yes. Cystic fibrosis, when it was first described in the 1930s, and was described in infants who died before they were a year old. By the early 1950s, when we developed a sweat test, which is how it used to be diagnosed before we had genetic testing, the patients with CF have elevated salt in their sweat. So if you find salt in the sweat, it suggests cystic fibrosis. In fact, in the 12th century, it was said if your baby is born salty, he will die young. So that might have been the first description of CF. So in the 1950s, when the CF was first diagnosed with sweat tests, the average survival was to 3 years of age.
Wow.
And because of various therapies, including antibiotics, pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy, chest physiotherapy, the lifespan of patients with cystic fibrosis has increased to nearly 38 years.
Wow. Well, that's quite significant if they were dying in infancy.
That's correct.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more. Because I know we're really on the cusp of something very, very different in terms of treatment. But what was going on in terms of treatment in the past? You mentioned them like a laundry list, but help us understand how you could help people in the past.
So, again, in the 1960s, we realized that infections played a big role. So antibiotics came on board, and treating with antibiotics made a big difference for our patients' lives. Then we learned that the mucus itself in the lungs causes the damage. So we learned the importance of chest physiotherapy, getting the mucus out, both by pounding on patients' chest as a way of loosening the mucus, and later in the 1990s, development of like a vest that vibrates very rapidly and helps clear the mucus.
Wow. And how effective were those treatments?
Reasonably effective. Those treatments brought the lifespan up to, let's say, the late teens. In the 1990s, we saw introduction of a few more innovations. A drug called Pulmozyme became available, and Pulmozyme thins the mucus by breaking up the chemical products of the infection-fighting cells that are very thick and prevent the clearance, and that added years to our patients' lives. We developed inhaled antibiotics for the purpose of treating patients with cystic fibrosis, and this allowed us to have patients on antibiotics most of the time as opposed to just three or four times a year when they might come in the hospital.
So prophylactically, it would prevent the infection from beginning.
Exactly. And then the pancreatic enzyme replacement was very important. This helped improve digestion, so the patients were now well-nourished and were much better able to fight off infection.
So in most of those cases, it sounds to me that they were approaching it from a symptomatic standpoint. They were looking at what symptoms were causing problems, leading to early death or malnutrition or whatever, and they were treating the symptoms effectively, though.
They were treating the symptoms fairly well, but not well enough. Patients were still dying young. But the big hope was, can we do something to prevent the symptoms in the first place? Can we correct something in the body that would prevent the disease from progressing?
So go back to what we talked about before the break. We know now there's a brand new drug. It was just approved recently by the FDA, Kalydeco.
Correct.
Tell us about the drug and why is this so different?
Okay, so we have to backtrack a little bit.
Sure.
So when we discovered the gene for cystic fibrosis and we started understanding that CFTR is the protein that's damaged, we started asking, how can we fix the problem? We talked about the gene trials that didn't work. And in the early 2000s, the National Cystic Fibrosis Foundation decided to invest $70 million in a really a wild card kind of experiment where they took cells that had cystic fibrosis and put hundreds of thousands of different chemicals on the cells and looked for which of these chemicals might have affected the function of those cells. And out of the maybe millions of chemicals, they found 5 or 10 that affected the function. And then they contracted with a company called Vertex to examine each of those chemicals and ask, will these chemicals be beneficial? And this new drug that was just released was one of those chemicals. Kalydeco is one of the millions of chemicals that was tested in this shotgun approach.
So what does it actually do?
It's a really good question. It's a little complicated to explain, so we have to backtrack a little bit. I mentioned the CFTR. That's a protein that causes cystic fibrosis. Its function in the cell is to transport chloride channel. Chloride is one of the ions that makes up salt. Sodium and chloride makes up salt. So its job is to move chloride. Patients with CF, they do not move chloride in their cell. Now, there are different kinds of CF, as it turns out. There are patients who are born with the defect, so the cell doesn't even make the chloride channel. So it's gone, it's absent. But there are patients with CF that the patient makes the chloride channel, but it's defective. It doesn't work. Turns out that Kalydeco turns on the chloride channel that doesn't work.
Wow.
So when given to patients who have the defective chloride channel, the disease seemed to be reversed somewhat. So for example, the sweat test, which I told you before, patients have a high elevated salt content. Given Kalydeco, their salt content is no longer elevated. And the patients given Kalydeco, their lung function improves and their weight improves. So it seems to be reversing some of the effects of disease. And in the study that we actually participated in at Upstate, we saw a great improvement in our patients. But the patients who were enrolled in this study were patients who already had disease, quite a bit of disease.
And the reason, so they were older patients.
They were older patients. And the reason for that is, number one, you don't want to test a new drug in babies. And number two, you wanted to have some room for improvement. So if the patients were really well, you couldn't see the effect of the drug as much. The most exciting thing about the drug is what would happen if we give this drug to young children who haven't had a lot of lung damage taking place. I believe it'll prevent the lung damage from starting.
And that suggests that they actually can live a fairly more normal life.
That's the hope.
That's the hope and the expectation.
And the expectation. I think it's a realistic expectation.
So that you are suggesting that, therefore, this drug, Kalydeco, at this point, doesn't work for all patients.
Unfortunately not. And unfortunately, the percentage of patients who have these defective chloride channels, as opposed to the absent ones, is only 4%. So in our center, we actually have 200 patients at our center. Only 4 of them, in our center, is only 2%, but only 4 of them are eligible for this drug.
Meaning that they might benefit from it.
Correct.
When you say eligible.
Correct.
So how do you determine, just very briefly, how do you determine who has this defective chloride channel or who doesn't have it at all? I mean, how is that done?
We do it through genetic testing. Okay. We can actually tell what kind of cystic fibrosis people have by looking at their genes.
So how well does it work, or what's the expectation now based on both the older patients who've already had some lung damage and you haven't yet? Have trials been run on young children without lung damage?
They have not done trials yet on younger children, although they're on the drawing boards. Hopefully in the next 3 to 5 years, those studies will be done. It's worked. As I mentioned, the patients in our center who were pretty sick to start with improved a great deal. So it worked as better than I could have expected in those patients. And I think with the healthier patients, it'll work even better.
Is it used, or will it be used in combination with these other therapies that you discussed earlier? In other words, the pancreatic therapies and all of that, or will it be used as alone?
That's a terrific question. We don't know yet. I would think that the patients who have lung damage already and already have pancreatic damage will need to continue to take the other therapies. But it's possible that healthy young patients given this drug may not require many of the other therapies.
You know, it strikes me that this whole story behind Kalydeco really says that, I know after the sequencing of the human genome, there was all this hope that there would be a bonanza of new drugs that would come out as a result. And you did mention that all of the original stuff about gene replacement wasn't working. But this did work, but at a great cost. And the cost seems to be staggering. I read somewhere it's going to cost almost $300,000 a year per patient.
That is correct. It's a great cost. And I should just interject really quick for any of our listeners who are thinking this may not apply to me if I have a loved one or if I have cystic fibrosis. Vertex is working on other compounds that may help the patients whose chloride channel doesn't work. Or it doesn't exist at all, so there's more coming down the pike, hopefully in a not-too-distant future. But getting back to the cost, yes, it seems like a staggering cost, but let's put this into perspective. For other genetic diseases, rare genetic diseases, costs can be as high as $600,000 a year. Some of the drug costs are that high. You have to remember that in the whole United States, there are only 1,000 patients who potentially could benefit from Kalydeco. So the pharmaceutical company needs to get a return on its investment. If it doesn't get it, it would not develop the drug. And we should take a look at what is the cost of care for our cystic fibrosis patients now. The average patient in our center who's taking the pancreatic enzymes, antibiotics, and pulmozyme, their cost might be close to $100,000 a year right now as we speak.
So it sounds staggering, but in the big picture, it's probably... It's more cost-effective, ultimately.
It could be more cost-effective. I wish it was somewhat lower, but, for the patients who can benefit, it's worth any cost.
Oh, my God, it absolutely is. Well, this is amazing news, very hopeful, and the fact that there are new drugs in the pipeline that Vertex is working on. I also read somewhere that Vertex may actually develop some programs to help patients pay for their drugs. Also very exciting. Well, thank you for sharing all this with us. My guest has been Dr. Ron Anbar, and he's the professor of pediatrics and medicine and the director of pediatric pulmonary medicine and the Cystic Fibrosis Center at Upstate Medical University. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back with more HealthLink on air, and we'll learn all about reflux disease in children. I'm Linda Cohen, and this is FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.